Hi, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the Ideas Salon podcast series, recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. Our next session, titled Home Elusive Home, features Alison Page, Alison Pennington, Jess Scully, and Mandy Nolan.
And I do just have to say, as someone that's written for The Echo for 22 years, who has never once been edited as far as the editorial line I take, that is a rare and amazing thing to happen in journalism. So to have a local, regionally based, independent media that grew out of our community and is here to actually reflect our voices is a great privilege and something I think we should never not acknowledge in that sense, what media can do. So give The Echo another big... just thought I'd give that little plug for The Echo.
You're getting a Mars bar at work on Monday, aren't you?
I know. I don't get paid very well, but I'm not going to put that. It's not about that. I do it for the... I get paid all right, but yeah. Okay. It's not under the table or anything.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, not yet. So I'd like to, of course, thank you to Arnie Delta, who was the voice that, if you live here, you know Delta, who tells the most extraordinary stories of country here. We're very privileged to have Delta, you know, sort of running the amazing tours that she does, that tells a story that we should all know of country and of place here. So I'd like to acknowledge that we are meeting today on beautiful Bundjalung country, the land of Arakwal people and Bumbalan Nation, sorry about that, and that this is and always will be Aboriginal land. We will come to that as our first point today. But before I introduce the speakers today, this is a topic. This is Home Elusive Home. I'm Mandy Nolan, and this is a topic and a conversation that I have been having and the community has been having with itself now and with each other for decades. As someone that has gone door knocking to ask people what they care about, this is what they care about. We were flood impacted in our region. Over 4,000 people lost their homes. We're currently, you know, an absolutely impacted community where we have conversations constantly about housing, about how we get people back into housing, but none of the structural changes actually exist to actually make that happen. We start to have conversations, you know, about great, sustainable, small homes, while the community in a largely tourist area now moves into the caravans and tiny houses the tourists used to stay in. And the people that travel here are the ones that end up staying in the large, very often empty and vacant homes. There is something very wrong in this place. We have higher homelessness here than City of Sydney. Now that tells you there is real systemic issues that hopefully we can address today, and we need to have a really important conversation. Talking about these issues is how you start the change. Never underestimate the power of conversation to move people to create innovation. So to start this conversation, but oh, sorry, I've got to introduce the panelists first. Mm-hmm. I was about to jump in. I was getting all excited. just going, I'm ready to solve
all of the problems today. I'm like, yeah. Crapping myself here.
well, yeah, we only have an hour too, so so you can start solving the problems. So sitting right here on my left is Jess Scully. Jess loves cities and has worked in the creative industries, arts policy, city making and urban policy. She held an elected position in local government for almost 7 years and wrote this book, which we're talking to today, Glimpses of Utopia, and invites us to borrow and steal better ideas from more sources to build a future we can actually look forward to. Please give a hand for Jess.
Hi.
And sitting in the middle of the couch is Alison Page, a Walbanga and Wadi Wadi woman. She's an award-winning designer and film producer whose care links Indigenous stories and traditional knowledge with contemporary design. I'm not sure what care is, but I think that's a typo. But who's not sure where that came from, but we know that. She's a chair of the
National... definitely came from me.
I know. I have to learn to proof what I copy and paste. She's the chair of the National Centre of Indigenous Excellence and a director of the National Australia Day Council. Please welcome Alison. And right down on the edge of the panel today, we have Alison Pennington, an economist and writer who draws on broad-based history of sociology and activism to investigate big economic issues facing people. To her, Home Elusive Home, the topic of today, is a product of an investor-dominated housing system tearing Australia's egalitarian compact at the seams. Please welcome Alison. So, Alison, in the middle, because we've got two Alisons, and both of the last name beginning with P, so I'll have to...
I'll be Alison in the middle.
Can you be Alison in the middle? Can you take the centrist position? No. Because, Alison, I'm asking, look, we need a radical shift in our thinking and the way we view housing and ownership. So, starting this panel, I'd love you to talk about home through First Nation understanding of country and explain Noora for us to actually frame this whole conversation where we can start with First Nation wisdom and knowledge.
So Noora is an Aboriginal language word meaning home. It's one of the only words that is common to, like, there's 300 and plus languages in Australia, and Noora is one of the common words for home. It doesn't refer to our architecture. In fact, you know, Aboriginal people had a sustainable architecture here that was, you know, made of ready-made materials, but it was more like a second skin. It was more like clothing. And we weren't really, even in the homes, say in Tasmania or Victoria, which was slightly more sedentary and had, you know, rock walls and things like that because of the colder climates, there wasn't really any, like, adornment of houses. So it wasn't really seen. We'd adorn our own skin with ochre and jewellery and the things and ornaments and things like that, but our homes weren't really where we sort of expressed our identity. So our homelands, on the other hand, which is a cultural landscape usually defined by a bioregion, was something that we loved so deeply and cared for so deeply that it became, it is and still is today to all Aboriginal people, you know, like a family member. It becomes this sort of animate sort of part of your everyday psyche. You have this dialogue with country. Part of that is about caring for the land, the sea and the sky, very sustainably and very deeply. Part of that is because we also didn't have the written words, so all of our ecological knowledge, so everything that we needed to know to live, all of our law, our science, all of our sciences, all of our social mores, were all encoded into stories which were then embedded into geographic locations and into objects. And when I say geographic locations, I also mean the stars. So these threads of knowledge that kind of crisscross the continent, they become, as you grow up and you learn your stories of country, those threads become more real and, you know, they become more tangible as you get older. So when I say threads, I mean, so when a star is on a horizon, a certain star constellation is on a horizon, that might tell you when this animal is breeding, but this plant is ready for harvest. So these lines that crisscross, and, you know, there'll be some story attached to that. And, you know, the more elaborate the story, I'm looking at shocked people because I just said cock. Like there's some women there that are just going, she just said that. So you remember though, you'll remember that. So the more memorable the story,
I'm all good for cock early in the morning.
Okay, great. Okay, I see where this is going. So what I'm saying is that as you walk through your Noora, as you walk through country over time, and, you know, and your bioregion defines you, so you're salt water, you're fresh water, you're a desert person, you know, they were half animal, half human, amazing, and they lifted up the land and they made different things. So, you know, that's why to our people, if you go and knock down that tree over there, you know, I remember going to Utnyamutna country down in the Flinders Ranges and, you know, this auntie was pointing out this, honestly, this tree just looked like this sort of like a twig, right? It didn't look like anything that remarkable. But when she told me that it was a birthing tree, that this person was, and I just thought, God, someone could just back into that and knock it over, you know? So, you know, when you destroy country, you're destroying the library. So you may as well take all these books and burn them. You know, like imagine how horrific, especially this audience, you know, how horrific that would feel. And that is, that's how I suppose deeply multidimensional, I suppose, the Aboriginal concept of home is. It's about belonging, it's about identity. And I think it is for all humans, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. I would love, Alison, to get to the stage where, and I often feel as, you know, a non-Indigenous host sitting in a largely non-Indigenous audience, how tiring it must be to continually have to explain a concept which should be something we know if we walk and live in this country. It would be great to get to that point where we actually understand that as part of how we make policy, particularly because we are basically, you know, building land. Well, all our policy exists on stolen land with an extractive approach, extractive capitalist approach, which seems to have been, as we know, with lots of different bad policies, the core of why we're in this situation. How can we change this idea or how we approach land to look towards reforming the way we approach housing? Because I know, Jess, you do a lot of work in Glimpses of Utopia on that very conversation. Would you mind speaking to that?
Oh, just a small one to start.
I know,
thanks
sorry.
Thanks so much. I love this panel already. This is great. So obviously we're starting in Australia from the basis of stolen land and a colonial mindset where everything the light touches, Simba, belongs to the crown. And despite the fact that we had a ruling, you know, that terra nullius, you know, didn't exist, that actually that crown land actually belongs to the first people here, that didn't seem to change anything in the 90s, and we rolled on. And on top of the stolen land kind of original sin, the kind of founding concept of Australia, we have layered a series of extraordinary assumptions and entitlements over who gets to do what and what that land is designed to serve. And one of the things that I said yesterday, if anyone came to the panel I was on yesterday, we've tried nothing and we're all out of ideas in Australia, essentially, and nowhere more so than in housing and in land. You know, other countries that exist in the world have in their constitutions, in their founding documents, treaty, but also they have an understanding and acknowledgement that there is an obligation inherent in the privilege of managing or owning land. You know, countries like Spain and Brazil and Colombia, you know, many, many countries around the world have a social purpose to land built in to their constitution. So what that means is that's fab that you own parcel X, but you part of Parcel X belongs to the community also. And if you were to realise some kind of development on that parcel, 20% of that would need to go back to the community in the form of a good residential allocation for affordable housing or social housing. 15% of that goes back to the community in the form of public space, parks, streets, those sorts of things. And there are also other obligations that are discharged through paying fees, paying for, you know, development rights, building rights. We don't have any of that. You basically get the land, maybe you pay rates, maybe you don't, maybe you pay a little DA sort of fee if you realise the gain, but the gain is extracted, it's privatised, and all of the benefit of the place where you live. Sure, it comes from the land, but the land isn't that creative in and of itself. It doesn't actually get 5% smarter and more interesting every year. It just gets more expensive. But the real value that's created is created through the activities of people, of the community. It's the barista, it's the bar, it's the train link or the bus route, you know, and those are social infrastructures that are subsidised by society and then extracted out to private value. So there's a fundamental issue there, and we need to sometimes take land out of the equation, and we can talk more about that later.
Thank you so much, Jess, for that. And I mean, that we can talk a little later too, very much about this. You know, we live in an area where we're seeing this entire metric play out in an amplified way, with climate change playing out, with an inability to access staffing for businesses. So the housing crisis no longer just affects people in housing. It affects people with housing and even with investment properties if they own a business, because they can't staff. Like, we're seeing that. But we'll come back to that, because we were talking about stolen land, and I want to speak, I guess I want to move down to Alison at the end, Alison Pennington, to talk about stolen futures. In your book, Generation Fucked, which is, there you go.
There is a question mark at the end, because it's not definitive.
Yes.
I ask the question is it effed, or can we do something about it? And the answer is yes, we can.
Well, yeah, and what you put forward, I think, in a way, is you're really critiquing the neoliberal system, which has meant that older generations are using younger generations for wealth creation, whether they want to or not, because very often it's very hard to be a grandparent using, you know, what is ostensibly your own grandchild to create wealth. But I'd love if you could speak a little about how this system has supercharged inequity and a kind of a loss of hope, I guess, for those under 35s.
I mean, dovetailing this point about whether this intergenerational transfer of wealth, which has happened, is good, whether people want it to happen or not. I want to start by saying it's not a... We have to be really careful to avoid the generational warfare narrative, because it's this divisive story that only the status quo benefits from. Certainly anyone who bought a house 20 years ago and it's realised, you know, 50% increase or more in its value, it's not their fault that this happened. But it has happened. And that's because there was a massive shift in the way that government related to housing, in a nutshell, right? Like, the reason why home ownership became generalised in Australia is because government played a proactive role in constructing, in giving cheap finance, concessional lending, shoring up supply chains. And that more hands-on approach up until the 70s was dramatically changed come the 80s. And essentially, I use the frame of the closed shop. Housing became a closed shop in Australia. And anyone who was in was part of the new exclusive wealth builders club. And and housing became more and more central to Australians' sense of identity, their sense of purpose, because their heads down, they were working harder on the job, working longer hours to pay bigger mortgages, and it meant our economy became more and more dependent on this essentially like super exploitative relation, really, like the debt bondage one. But the other side of that means that essentially having a mortgage is now some sort of privilege, right, which is crazy. In the same way that having a full-time secure job, the ones that many Australians conceive of when they think of a good job, is now some sort of privilege to have a permanent, you know, relationship to full-time exploitation. I know, when I got in the pearly gates of full-time work at the age of 26, I was like, oh, shit, no, this is what it's all about, okay. And Australia is building on this kind of historic layering. Like, it's what makes housing really difficult to talk about and to push for new solutions is because it's so embedded in how struggle developed in the colonies. Because, you know, the working class was imported in chains through convict transportation to Australia, and they brought all of them, their social movements, their fight for unionism, for the right to vote. Because none of the colonies had this these freedoms, and they were tied up. They were forced to labour. Many came out of prisons. We had the Master and Servant Acts period, which tied a worker to an employer. If you left your employer, you could go to jail. These types of relationships, and then, you know, what the way people revolted against that system was to fight for the right to vote, the right to unionise, the right for your work to give you a good life. So the right to earn an income that lets you buy a home is so critical to consciousness in Australia. And that's what makes a lot of this hard, because for people who own a home, they fought for that. They believe they did. And in historically, there is some truth. There is truth to that. But the question we now face, which is essentially this feudal-like relation, has gone into hyperdrive, and it's dividing us, and it's getting to the point where who truly benefits is becoming clearer and clearer, which is this, you know, top 10% essentially of income earners, who are disproportionately older by way of being born into wealth and born at the right time. And it's for young Australians, I think, where unless they're born into wealth that's passed on to them, like this equation of, you know, what is the fair go? Why do I work? To achieve what, for what purpose? All these questions are coming up now against the backdrop, of course, you know, climate crisis, and, you know, a building sense of, you know, what contribution can I make, and what is the purpose of that? And housing, I think, is at the centre of that.
Absolutely. And I think you'll find even in when I have conversations with people, particularly people under 35 or under 40 around housing, that expectation or that the sense that housing was part of a trajectory of where you were headed is kind of gone. Because when someone has housing under that age, every time I ask about their housing situation, they go, I'm really lucky. I managed to buy a house. And
I'm really lucky. I've got a $1.5 million mortgage.
I know, exactly. And sometimes then, like, yeah, you've got this massive mortgage that you're enslaved to. Ooh. And there's a sense that it's not like housing has become so exclusive and difficult that it's shut everybody out.
We are reaching the point where the average value of a mortgage, even with two income earners, because that's the other effect of the neoliberal economy, is it forced two incomes to be necessary to buy a house, is that you can finish your working life now and not be at the end of your term, right? And we know what this looks like. You look at the Eurozone, where they started handing debt over through generations, super destabilizing. Like, and not to mention the fact that our whole pension system relies on the assumption that someone's going to own a home when they retire. Like, it's a ticking time bomb. And if we don't do something about it, well, we already know what it looks like, you know.
Well, yeah, we do, because we've gone from here anyway. We've gone from a climate, you know, emergency to a housing emergency to a housing disaster, along with the climate. So, I'd love to just bring sort of pivot slightly across to talking around the impact of climate, particularly here, where so many people have lost their home, and the need then and to to decolonise the way we think about housing, because perhaps what's happened in our region, as well as how horrendous it has been for so many people, is this an opportunity for us to rethink with those kind of values and ideas around adaptation and around how we move our housing to look towards more of a First Nations approach about how we come back. Alison?
What happened really during colonisation is the transplanting of architectural styles and borrowed landscapes from England and from Europe. And, you know, this concept of the European villa. And, you know, architects are still obsessed with the idea, you know, and look at the Farnsworth House or, you know, these great modernist houses that, you know, they're gorgeous. They, you know, they're made of glass and they let the landscape in, but they're on massive properties, you know. And so this idea of having the villa that is connected to nature is still something that we are kind of obsessed with, because, you know, it's like a temple to us as individuals. It's like, oh, wow, you know, like I've arrived, you know, in life, you know. And so I think, and really it's why we're looking at these sprawling suburbs. I mean, you look at Sydney and, you know, these massive houses, you know, and the eaves of the next door neighbour are like 1.5 metres away from the eaves of the other one, and they've got a fence between them, so luckily, you know, they don't have to talk to each other. But, you know, like it's really... You know, Western Sydney is an interesting case, because even Governor Macquarie was actually like, he was out looking at land out west for farming, and he sort of said to he was talking to the natives, and he said, why are all those leaves up in the trees? And they said, well, the whole place floods, you know, it's underwater. And so they went, anyway, let's just keep building out there. Let's build more and more houses out there. So, you know, it's not, you know, the only way that Aboriginal people over 65,000 years survived climatic changes, major climatic changes. In fact, Aboriginal people had to abandon 80% of the landmass in order to survive the Ice Age. Which is why I think, you know, sure, I'm sure somebody threw some mud in the fire and invented clay, but they just kind of saw the future and just went, no way. We're not going to carry heavy things around with us. We're just going to stay lightweight, move around. And, you know, quite frankly, we're going to need some... First of all, we're just going to have to abandon, you know, these architectural styles from Europe, and stop bringing them here, especially in the sort of Australian ugliness on steroids version that we're getting now. But to actually co-design with country and to actually listen to country, part of that is about talking to First Nations people who have, through their stories. A lot of the stories that we have are actually eyewitness accounts of climate events. So to actually think about, okay, this 100-year flood we're talking about is probably going to be a next year flood now. So how do we, you know, and Lismore is actually grappling with this right now. You know, is it possible for us to have houses that move? You know, we're just going to have to start thinking about that. This idea that, you know, this is, you know, I think it's going to take, you know, sure, there's a pragmatic kind of problem here about designing for climate change. But the bigger problem that we kind of need to sort of address here is the fact that we've equated our homes and our home ownership with our entire sense of belonging to this land. You know, and I think if you can, like, pull those two things apart, you know, which is where, you know, the social infrastructure comes in, or, you know, just letting go of, you know, your whole sense of self is wrapped up in this house.
That's entirely true, because sometimes it feels like, you know, and, you know, I feel like sometimes so much time is spent maintaining a giant Tupperware container for stuff I don't even know I've had that when I die someone else has to deal with. Like this attachment to storing the stuff that's choking the planet. There's so much stuff in there, I've had to build a giant house to store it so other people can't, you know. So can we talk about, I'm going to move across to Jess, but do feel you can jump in at any point here. Let's talk about other models. Let's talk about what can be done. Let's talk about possibly why we need to break that kind of nuclear family, not just the whole nuclear family, but how that idea isn't always representative of community. And when we're talking about housing, we've got to talk about diversity as much as we do across the biodiversity in the natural world and in the human world, that this is where we need it to happen.
Oh, I just want to carry on something Ali just said. You know, when the reverse of that, building, tying our identity and sense of belonging to home ownership, is we are going to, we are having generations of people who feel shut out of belonging and feel shut out of places and out of community. You know, where I live in the city of Sydney, 65% of us are tenants, which is higher than the national average. Sorry, it's double the national average. And I, you know, over the period that I was in elected office, I would meet with people and say, hey, what do you think about local government? Oh, I'm a renter, so I don't get to have a say. You're like, no, you do. But there's a real belief amongst people who, you know, are on six-month leases, who know that their rent is probably going to be put up at the end of those 6 months, who don't know where they're going to live next, who feel insecure and unstable all the time. How and why would you put down roots? Why would you feel connected to a place? Why would you plant in the community garden? Why would you volunteer if you had the time to do it? You know, we are creating a huge amount of social instability that is shaking the foundations of this system that we have. And at the same time, we're creating a whole lot of financial, economic instability by, I described it the other day as the Australian housing market is the cockroach that didn't die during the GFC. And then we thought, let's build our economy on the back of the cockroach because that seems to be working. And we have created such a fragile system by telling everyone that this mortgage is the basis for your stability, your retirement, your children's future. Everything is
your identity.
And your identity, of course. So, I mean, first of all, we need to talk about tenancy differently. We absolutely need a higher degree of, you know, actual renters' rights in this country. That's essential. But we also need to look at the housing model in a more holistic way. And so there's this concept which is called the housing continuum. And the housing continuum basically is, it's not, you know, blue or red. It's basically, it's not buying a house or being a renter. There's this whole range of different flavours in the middle. So you've got social housing, you've got community housing, co-housing, you've got affordable market rental or subsidised or supported market rental, you got market rental and you got market housing, and there's lots of different variations on the way in between that other places in the world have, and we could have it too. And we also, so we need to flesh out the housing continuum and we need to look at what the issues are, what are the impediments to that actually happening. And in my experience, there are a couple of key impediments. There's a financing barrier in that banks prefer to lend to the thing that is most common, which is, you know, individual family houses. Even those banks that are meant to be there for an ethical or for purpose entity, like, you know, mutual societies, they see a risk in something that's unconventional, like a co-housing or a cooperative sort of model. So we need to address that. We need to talk about land, more specifically about how do we take land out of the equation. There are things like community land trusts, which I know you've got a community land trust that people are creating here in Byron, which is extraordinary. It's such a good model to take land out of the equation and create permanent affordability. And then we need to look at social housing and affordable housing in a much more widespread way. So in Australia, social housing is 2% of our housing mix. It used to be 6%, which is still not enough, but it's 2%. In the Netherlands, it's 29% of the housing market. And no one thinks of the Netherlands with a stigma that this is a, you know, nation of houses, right? Which is the stigma that we
There's
have.
Nothing wrong with that.
I know,
because I'm a houser.
But, you know, but this is the perception we have in this country about social housing. It is essential in a place like Vienna, frequently the, you know, the best place to live in the world, 80% of people are eligible for social housing, 45% of people live in social housing, nation of housers. And so that's something that governments can intervene in to create.
Absolutely. Alison, would you like to jump in here? Because I know that you've written quite a bit about the need for change. Also, it's coming back a little bit and talking about rent freezes as well and the need to and how that kind of regulation might help kind of dampen down some of the inflammation that's in the housing market right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I'll answer the question by going around to the root of it, because okay, well, first I wanted to say about public and social housing. Okay, so part of the reason it also has this horrible rap is because it exists in opposition to owner occupation. Yeah. And historically, Australia has actually done public housing really terribly. Like, even compared to even other Anglo countries, we never had a lot of it and we sold off a lot of it. It was a very, you know, it was the Thatcherite era of the best way to placate the masses is by giving them a slice of the market. And that's what we did in Australia. We sold off public housing to tenants and said the best thing you can do is own. But they're highly paternalistic arrangements. We have from the start assumed that public and social housing will only be for people who fall through the cracks, not workers. It's for the underclass. It's for single mothers. It's for people with drug and alcohol problems. And so we actually also concentrated disadvantage at the bottom end of an undersupplied public housing system. And then we put them in these, you know, god-awful, you know, concrete little matchboxes. And we run them in this highly bureaucratic, paternalistic way, which is that government knows best always. And that's another level of evolution we have to have in public and social housing in Australia, is the governance models. Absolutely. It's about more democratic participation of the place in which you live, giving people a say at the table about how they live and the community they live in. So I think that's a new chapter for Australia in public and social housing. The GFC, the cockroach, I wanted to raise this one because Australia was celebrated for missing out on the worst of the GFC collapse, and everyone thought it would be the end of the housing market and we'd all go down. And like, that is because the Labor government at the time, you know, had this stimulus policy which kept consumption afloat. But the other thing that happened during the GFC is that the big national banks increased their concentration and monopoly control of credit, and we had some competition in wholesale lending, but they used the crisis to buy out smaller operators like Aussie Loans, and they increased their stranglehold. And actually at this point, like over 60% of all of national bank liabilities are in mortgages. So this is, we're not just talking about the social relation or the economic undersupply of housing. Like, we're talking about very powerful interests in finance and developers who work together to create this kind of ratcheting up effect of the population. They have an interest in just doing mortgages. That's their business. And that's not a very sophisticated economy, right? Like, we don't have business investment anywhere near at the scale we need. We have people lending for mortgages. So your initial question, I'm not sure if...
I wanted to actually just go back to, because renters get, like, in every conversation we have, renters always, we kind of forget, you know, and it's happening government policy right now. It's what we need to push for too, is for renters in the community, what kind of policy adjustments can be made? Yes. You know, do rent freezes work, in your opinion?
So there's, because of that financing frame, each time interest rates are ratcheted up in this inflation war that's going on now, landlords pass on the increases to tenants and no one is intercepting this relationship. There are landlords who could go under, but the vast majority probably could sustain a hit. But we don't have any regulation for that arrangement. It's a private interaction between the owner and the person who's the tenant. Young people need to be protected. 60% of under 30-year-olds are renting. They need to be protected from that automatic flow on. But also 70% of young people want to own a home. That's actually also a reality we have to grapple with, which is how do we extend, well, not own a home, they think that housing security and government should play a key role in ensuring that, and they think it's a goal in their lives at some point to own a home. We have to ensure that we are, you know, building a new model for government that is focused on the attainment of public, social, community, affordable housing, and some kind of light at the end of the tunnel at this time, because we know we have a gross undersupply of rental properties, a gross undersupply of housing, and plenty of empty ones too, that we should do something about freeing up those properties for rent, I think.
Can we talk about this is where it always, like particularly in this region, when we talk gross undersupply, it sounds like incentive to hit the accelerator on building, and we can't really talk about supply until we address the unused supply and investment and speculative supply. Right here in this region, most people know Airbnb, short-term holiday letting platforms, have created a massive issue. While community are living in pods outside supermarkets in a very public areas, which is probably all, it's interim housing, there are houses throughout this community, large and too affluent to be used now for a rental market. You know, 1 million houses at the census were empty. How do we, and this is to any of you here, how do we hope to address this speculative market that has used housing as investment wealth creation and created these empty houses? Like we can't talk about supply, I think, until we deal with what's happened with, you know, negative gearing and the neoliberal explosion of housing investment.
I'm aware I don't want to overtalk, but like I think it's worth recognizing Australia's been at this point before, and it was the Depression, and people crammed into unsanitary, overcrowded houses run by powerful landlords was seen to be a marker of like the derelict condition of Australian people. And the way we resolved that is we had this mass expansion of owner occupation. And what that meant was government had to compete with the private sector's control of housing supply in order for people to get houses. And I think that sets the stage for now. But I think the conclusion is different, which is resolving this tension is about evolving our relationship to land and having a government stepping in to secure the supply of cheap, affordable, public, social housing that begins to buffer some of the control of private developers in supply. Because you're exactly right. This is what, you know, big business peaks and powerful business peaks will say is like, well, it's just a supply problem. That doesn't sort the cost issue of which, if you need a deposit for a median unit in a capital city, you need $120,000. Who's got that much money? I mean, only people who are born into wealth will get money from their parents, which are a small percentage of people, but it's needing to intervene into the control and stranglehold of private interest in supply.
But didn't, in 1927, didn't renters just stop paying?
Did they? What a great idea.
They stopped paying rent.
Yeah,
well, rental strikes. Because they didn't have any work. Yeah. And so they just stopped paying rent. So who were the losers in 1927? The landlords. They lost their properties. They couldn't pay their mortgages and the banks.
Yeah. And Jess, you've probably followed some of this with like council politics, but in response to COVID, there was a bunch of rental strikes across the world, right? And yeah. Was there one in Sydney?
There wasn't one in Sydney, unfortunately. I mean, I think there's so much to say about this, and I want to say two things specifically. Well, first of all, the broken system we have is working perfectly as designed. We're getting exactly the outcome that all of our incentives have created. Mm. So if we want anything to be different, it has to change at a policy level, and the only way that changes is through collective political action. So we have to do something.
Yeah.
We have more landlords in Parliament than renters. That's for bloody sure.
Yeah.
Right? What is it? On average, something like 2 or 3 properties per elected parliamentarian at the very least. Some of them have 30 or so. I was telling Ali that, you know, I had someone on council with me who so like, I have 55 properties. I sold one of them to run my campaign. Oof. You know, in a local government area where 65% of people rent, you know. So first of all, leadership is not going to come from government on this. Every incentive points towards them not making change. If we want change, it has to happen from the grassroots, and we have to know what to ask for. The second thing I want to say is we live in a highly subsidised housing system in Australia. The problem is we're subsidising the wrong end of the system. We spend $8.5 billion a year subsidising negative gearing last year. By 2032, we will spend $20 billion a year subsidising a tax concession for people who own more than one property. So we are choosing to do that. That wasn't handed down on a stone tablet. We decided to do that, so we can change that tomorrow. And the third thing I'll say is housing and development are kind of the same thing. So if you want to solve the housing problem, you have to understand that development needs to occur in your community. Okay. And so I am a big YIMBY, a person who says yes in my backyard. I don't think more supply will solve all the problems. We need more supply of affordable housing. We need more supply with inclusionary zoning or levies, affordable housing levies attached to it. But you can't in the same breath say, we need to solve the housing crisis. Don't build anything next to me. And that's what you get all day long in local government, all day long. Right? So if you want a place where your kids or grandkids can live in your community, if you want a barista who can work in your neighbourhood, if you want a teacher or a doctor or maybe not a doctor, a nurse, you know, you need to have housing they can afford to live in. I don't need to tell you guys, you know that's happening here. People are coming from Logan to work here, right? So you have to allow development to happen.
I think that's true, but at the same time, I think you have a city-centric approach. And I don't only saying, which is okay, but when you say not in my backyard, whole environmental movements have fought in this region because we are dealing. So it is a fragile balance between yes in my backyard.
But if you don't do anything, what you're going to get is like sprawling, like one villa on not even a quarter acre anymore. Like it's we need different types of design, like great architecture, you know, medium density is a much better way to live. And I think this is about actually, I mean, we've already decided we're going to be living in an apartment block together when we grow old, right? I don't want to live far away from you. Average commute for people now is 50 minutes to get to work and away from work. Like, it's ridiculous. But, and it will, I live in Coffs Harbour, right? It's happening there. And also the problem with a lot of regions as well is that you don't have the design controls within local councils there, so there just isn't the capability or the expertise to say, you know, oh, here's a plan. Oh, yeah, right, corrugated iron balustrading on the balconies. That's great, I'll sign that. You know, and that's what's actually happening. And I'm just seeing some of the work. It's not even it is architecture, but it's just horrible design. And that's what you're going to get if we don't actually get more purposeful and accept that we actually need more medium and high density housing, because the population's not going anywhere.
And the population's aging. And yeah, people, absolutely. As they get older, it's harder for them to drive to the doctors or to pick up their groceries. People need to live in more compact ways.
Urban areas.
But we need to also, we can do that at medium density, and we have to have, everything comes down to regulation, we have to have better climate climate aware and regionally aware regulation around how we build houses.
Yeah, because I think what's different for regional areas, and I think that tension between YIMBY and NIMBY, I think we really have to explore, and I'd love to work into that, because when we're talking here, not being, you know, ideas of medium density, understanding what needs to happen, but we're also dealing about developments that are sometimes fringing on native forest, developments that are impacting fragile environmental, systems. So having that, like, that doesn't
happen. Well, that's going to take regulations.
Yeah.
So in New South Wales, we're lucky here that all state government-run developments have to demonstrate, and this was a government-led policy, they have to demonstrate how this development is connecting with country. That's only state significant projects. So if the state government, the New South Wales government's coming in to do a development in your area, then you can at least feel slightly relaxed that at least they have to demonstrate what's becoming quite a very strict co-design process with traditional owners, with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to integrate. It's no longer now just star green star rating. It's a fully integrated approach, and it looks at how the place is being activated and how it will be cared for after the developers have gone as well. So you really do have to hit developers over the head with a big stick sometimes and create laws and regulations. You just do.
Absolutely.
But at the local government, that is not a requirement at this stage to co-design with country. It's not, and it should be.
Absolutely.
And I think just to add one little thing to that, there's different kinds of development, right? And there's different kinds of developers. So when you have community housing providers, for example, or for-purpose permanent affordability housing, which could be cooperatives or co-housing or different kinds of housing models, where the organisation who builds that property owns it in the long term, they build better housing. They build it to be passively cooled. They build it so you don't have to turn the aircon on. They build it so that the thing doesn't fall down after 7 years when the builder's warranty expires, which is different to the market. If we just...
Or that it's connected to nature and it's got natural value.
But the trees can be, they don't use up the whole site, so you have natural shading. So not all developers are the same, actually, but we need to have regulation and incentives so that we get more of the affordable and community housing that Alison's talking about as well.
I was just going to kind of not sum up but like articulate what I think is, it's not a real difference of opinion around like whether you are contesting development or you're advocating for better development. Like what's the key difference here is the participation of people in the process. And like I think for communities like, here and lots of other places in Australia, people have naturally banded together to protect themselves against powerful interests in development. And that's a very natural thing to do if you don't have control of this, tidal wave coming to you and no capacity to influence the design parameters, whether it's sustainable, whether you're going to cut down a forest to do it. So I think it's people power at the centre of the design question. Yeah.
Thank you. And well done. That is a great. So we've only got about 5 minutes to drive this session home. I think I wanted to come to the fact that every night in this country, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, so it's probably an underestimate, 123,000 people sleep rough. The homelessness impact and the communities who are most significantly impacted by that. We need to include that in our conversation about policy and housing and and how we take that forward with person-centred politics. I recently went and spoke with the Anti-Poverty Centre in Sydney, and one of the main things that came out of that conversation was how rarely people who live in poverty are at the table when policies are created around their life outcomes. Do you mind bringing us home with a little bit closer?
Cool, you brought up Anti-Poverty Centre. I used to work, was an activist in Adelaide for the anti-poverty work there. And I think it's a kind of a good entry point because for those 120,000 people, they didn't do anything wrong. Like, we've all sit here and we talk about the structural reasons why this happens, yet we see people on the streets, we walk past them, we feel terrible, maybe throw a few dollars. We know that this is like a really big problem. Also, part of, you know, putting people at the centre is acknowledging that they given the capacity to articulate their needs, they will. If they have agency in their lives, they like they need support. But it's on all of us to recognise that they're not policy problems. They're part of us. They could be us, right? Like, I'm sure many of you know people who are kind of on the cusp right now. You know, and the fact is, working a job right now is not enough to get out of that situation.
No,
like
no.
Working a job can still land you in a position of not having a home. So,
yeah, there's people in Coffs Harbour at the moment. There's like Coffs Creek is just this beautiful creek that flows through the city, but there's whole families living in their cars and the two parents work. But and it's not that they've got the money to rent, but when you go to one of the rental things, it's like bidding and and you know, and the real estate agents in Coffs Harbour think they're the cleverest people alive. You know, because they've just made so much money. But to me, I think it's a, you know, in Aboriginal, one of the really important aspects of Aboriginal justice is shame. And for us to actually make change, I reckon the person who sits there at the dinner table the next time you guys have dinner and brags about how much property they own, shame job. Shame job.
I chaired this really interesting panel recently with a philosopher from the Netherlands called Ingrid Robens, and she espouses a theory. She's developed a theory called limitarianism, which she's got a book coming out early next year about it. And basically what she talked about was the fact that, you know, housing isn't an asset like another asset because it's a fundamental human necessity. It's shelter, right? We need to treat it differently than other assets. And so, but we are not going to get that from the system that we have today. So what I'd like to see is some kind of really significant public intervention where we have something like a citizens' convention on housing, because we kind of need a circuit breaker, because there are a million Australians who are landlords, 31% of Australians have a mortgage. We're not going to get anyone with the political courage to intervene and change that system from the political system we have today. But we know we can't live in a functioning society until we redesign housing to put the moral and ethical basis of what housing is at the core of it, right? And so we need to have that more foundational conversation about what housing is, what purpose it serves, how fundamental it is to having a secure society. And then we need to say, okay, what are the other options? You know, there are ideas from, Spain, Colombia, Korea, like there are ideas all over the world we could be borrowing, Brazil, that we could bring here, and just give some things a go.
Thank you so much. That has been our panel today. If you don't mind holding your books up, housing is a human right. All three of these books have been, I've read them and wrote all through them, incredible resources, research, ideas and information to have this conversation, to make change at a grassroots level. Part of that is knowledge, and part of that is broadening the conversations that you have in your community with your local council, with your local MP. Get the information, buy those books, see them over there at the bookshop. Please put your hands together for Jess Scully, Alison Pennington and Alison Page.
And Mandy Nolan. Yeah. Mandy Nolan.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.